Welcome to the Near Post Local, football and futsal in the capital region, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. I'm Peter Funnell. In tonight's program, we ask a very interesting question that often emerges in football, in football clubs, and about football at the national level. Are we underachieving? Well, is your club underachieving? Are the Socceroos or Matildas underachieving? Is your W League club or A League club underachieving? Now, to facilitate this discussion, I've drawn upon that excellent book, Why England Lose and Other Curiosities Explained. The same book was also titled Socceronomics, written by Simon Cooper and Stefan Szymanski. A wonderful book and a must-have in your football library. But they asked the same question. Their question is England underachieving? Now, many people will feel they know the answer to that, but this program might set you back on your heels and start you thinking. And thinking is important in football. Key elements in the analysis include home ground advantage, the international experience in the team, the population, that is the national population, and wealth. At a national level, of course, that's GDP. The coach effect, if any. Interestingly enough, the unit of analysis is goal difference, not specifically win, lose, draw. And if you think about it, goal differences tell you a heck of a lot about how a team is travelling. Reflect on your own team's performance over the last 4 or 5 years, let's say in the Premier League here. Now, while this analysis is pitched at a national level, in this case England, the elements of the analysis are most instructive and help us reflect on how our club, Premier League club, let's say, is travelling. Does your home ground give you an advantage? That is, if you have a home ground, and that itself might be an issue. How much experience does your team have? Quality, first grade, let's say, Premier League experience. In the case of population, how big is your player base? Do you have a large junior club? If you don't, where do you get your players from? Wealth. Oh, big issue for Premier League clubs. Some have licensed clubs, generous sponsors, and quite a few others simply have canteens, sausage sizzles and raffles. And of course, the coach effect. Does it impact in a productive way in your club? Do you have a coach or do you have a trainer? Well, that's up to you to decide. But does it have an effect? And if so, what's the effect? But back to the analysis that we'll hear tonight. Again, it's pitched at a national level. The question for them is England underachieving? The analysis is most illuminating. This is definitely for listening and thinking. Hope you enjoy it.
Hang on a moment. Who says England underachieve? Should do better. Are England worse than they ought to be? That England underachieve is usually taken for granted in the British media. After all, the team haven't won anything since 1966, and sometimes don't even qualify for tournaments. Clearly, that is not good enough for the mother country of football, birthplace of the greatest game. But are England really underachievers? Or is it just that the English expect too much of them? To answer this, we first need to work out how well England should do given their resources. Before we are accused of looking for excuses, let's consider what is and isn't possible. A 5-year-old can't win the 100 metres final at the Olympics, and neither can a 70-year-old. You aren't going to have a career in the NBA if you are only 5 foot tall, and you'll never cox Oxford in the boat race if you are 6 foot eight. It is very unlikely that you will have a career in show jumping if your parents earn less than £20,000 per year. You probably won't win a boxing match if you've never had any training as a boxer, and you won't have a shot at being world chess champion unless you can persuade a team of grandmasters to act as your seconds. Genetics are beyond our control. Training depends partly on our own effort, but partly on the resources that other people give us. What is true for the individual is also true for the nation. During his tenure, an England football manager cannot easily A. increase the size of the population from which he will have to draw the talent, B. increase the national income so as to ensure a significant increase in the financial resources devoted to developing football, or C. increase the accumulated experience of the national team by very much. England have played over 800 games since their first game in 1872, and currently play around a dozen games per year, so each extra game doesn't add much to the history. Yet, in any international match, these three factors, the size of the nation's population, the size of the national income, and the country's experience in international football, hugely affect the outcome. It's unfair to expect Belarus, say, to perform as well as much larger, more experienced and richer Germany. It is fairer to assess how well each country should perform given its experience, income and population, and then to measure that expected performance against reality. Countries like Belarus or Luxembourg will never win a World Cup. The only measure of performance that makes any sense for them is one based on how effectively they use their limited resources. The same exercise makes sense for England too, if only as a check on tabloid hysteria. Do England really underperform, given what they have to work with? In absolute terms, England are about 10th in the world. But we want to know how well they do in relative terms. Not relative to the expectations of the media, but relative to English resources. Might it be that England, in fact, overachieve, given the country's experience, population, and income? To work this out, we need to know the football results for all the national teams in the world. Luckily, we have them. There are a number of databases around of international matches, but one of the best is maintained by Russell Gerrard, a mathematics professor at Cass Business School in the City of London. By day, Russell worries about mathematical ways to represent the management problems of pension funds. For example, his most recent paper is snappily entitled Mean Variance Optimization Problems for the Accumulation Phase in a Defined Benefit Plan. It concerns, among other things, Levy diffusion financial markets, the Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, and the Feynman-CAC representation. As you might expect, Russell has been meticulous in accumulating the football data, which took him 7 years of his life. His database runs from 1872 to 2001 and includes 22,130 games. Russell Gerrard, Brilliant Football Database. Later in the book, we will crunch Russell's data to discover which is the best football country on earth and which punches most above its weight. But here, let's limit ourselves to a sneak preview of where England stand. The distant past is of limited relevance. Let's therefore concentrate on the most recent period of Russell's database, 1980 to 2001. This was by no means a golden age for England. The country didn't even qualify for the European Championships of 1984 or for the World Cup 10 years later. And their best moments in these 22 years were two lost semi-finals. Altogether in the period, England played 228 matches. They won 49% of them and drew 32%, for a win percentage of 65%. Remember that for these purposes, we treat a draw as half a win. That is near the middle of their historical range. We want to see how much of a team's success, match by match, can be explained by population, wealth and experience. However, win percentage is not the best measure of success, because any two wins are not the same. We all know that a 5-1 away win against a certain someone is not the same as a tame 1-0. To put it another way, if England play Luxembourg and win only 1-0, it's more likely that the Luxembourgeois press will be in ecstasy than the sun. Instead, we choose goal difference as our measure, since for any match we expect that the greater the difference between the two teams' population, wealth and experience, the greater will be the disparity in scores. Of course, a positive goal difference tends to be closely correlated with winning. We then analysed Russell's database of matches using the technique of multiple regression. Quite simply, multiple regression is a mathematical formula first identified by the mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss in 1801 for finding the closest statistical fit between one thing, in this case success of the national team, and any other collection of things, here experience, population and income per head. The idea is beautifully simple. The problem used to be the endless amount of computation required to find the closest fit. Luckily, modern computers have reduced this process to the press of a button. Just look up regression on your spreadsheet package. For each international match, you simply input the population, income per head and team experience of the two nations at that date, and in seconds you get a readout telling you how sensitive, on average, the team's performance is to each factor. We will also take account of home advantage for each match. Collecting the data is usually the toughest part. We have assembled figures for the population, football experience and income per capita of 189 countries. We will unveil our findings about the other 188 countries later in the book. Here, we will just focus on England and their supposed underperformance. We ran our regression and immediately made several discoveries about international football. First, home advantage alone is worth a lead of about two-thirds of a goal. Obviously, that is a nonsense if applied to a single game. But think of it this way. Playing at home is like having a goals head start in two out of three games. Second, having twice as much international experience as your rival is worth just over half a goal. In fact, experience turns out to matter much more than the size of your population, which is why the Swedes and Czechs do better at World Cups than very large but inexperienced Nigeria. The finding suggests that experienced Scotland should win rather more than they have been recently. Having twice your opponent's population is worth only about one-tenth of a goal. Having twice the GDP per head is worth about as little. In other words, although being large and rich helps a country win football matches, being experienced helps a lot more. It should be added that our estimates are statistically very reliable. Not only is there not much doubt that these factors matter, but there is little doubt about the size of the effects. It is these effects that make the first rounds of World Cups fairly predictable. However, much still remains unexplained. Experience, population and income per head combined explain only just over a quarter of the variation in goal difference. That is good news. If we could predict outcomes perfectly by just these three factors, there would not be much point in watching World Cups at all. Nonetheless, the fact that these three factors explain so much tells us that, up to a point, football is rational and predictable. For now, we are only interested in England. Are its resources so outstanding that it should do better than merely ranking around 10th in the world? First, let's look at experience. England is one of the most experienced countries in football. It played 790 internationals between 1872 and 2001. According to Russell's data, only Sweden played more, namely 802. However, England's much-vaunted history is not worth much against the other leading football nations because most of them have now accumulated similar amounts of experience. Brazil, Argentina and Germany had all played more than 700 internationals by 2001. When it comes to our second variable, national income, England scores highly too. It is usually one of the richest of the serious football countries. Where England falls short is in size. What often seems to go unnoticed is that without the other home nations, England's population of 51 million puts it at a major disadvantage to the countries it likes to measure itself against in football. Not only is Germany much bigger, with 80 million inhabitants, but France and Italy have around 60 million each. Among the leading European nations, England are ahead only of those other notorious underachievers, Spain, 40 million. So, in football terms, England is an experienced, rich, but medium-sized competitor. Then, we ran the numbers. We calculated that England, given their population, income and experience, should score, on average, 0.63 goals per game more than their opponents. To get a feel for how this works, consider England's performance at the World Cup of 1998. England played Tunisia, Romania, Colombia and Argentina, all on neutral ground, so there was no home field effect. Facing Tunisia in their opening game, England had a population five times larger, a GDP per head four times larger, and two times more international experience than their opponents. That combination gave an expected goal difference of one goal in England's favour. In the event, England won 2-0, and so did better than expected. Against Romania, England had the advantage of twice the population, five times the income per head, and a bit more experience. Other countries have been playing football for longer than we sometimes like to think. All this gave England an expected advantage of about half a goal. England's 2-1 defeat meant that they underperformed by 1.5 goals. Next, England played Colombia, with a slight advantage in population, four times the income per head, and double the experience. The package was worth an advantage of almost an entire goal. You start to see how the Tom Thumb World Cup might be organised, but again, England overperformed, winning 2-0. Then came Argentina. That goal, that sending off, that disallowed header, and that penalty shootout. If you were under 16, well done for reading this book, and now go ask your parents what we're talking about. Should England have done better? Well, they had a slight advantage in population over Argentina, double the income per head, but slightly less experience. Argentina play a lot of games. Putting all that together, a fair score would have been a draw, which is exactly what happened after 120 minutes. Pity about the penalties, but more about those later in the book. Our model allows us to re-examine every game ever played. The glorious uncertainty of football means that there are many deviations from expectation. However, if we average the difference between expectations and results for each country, we get a picture of whether any national team systematically overperforms or underperforms relative to its resources. Our finding. England, in the 1980 to 2001 period, outscored their opponents by 0.84 goals per game, or 0.21 more than expected. In short, they were not underperforming at all. Contrary to popular opinion, they were overperforming. As an example, take England's games against Poland. England played them 11 times in the period, won 7 and drew 4, with a goal difference of plus 16. Over the period, England's population was about 25% larger than Poland's, its income per head about three times greater, and its international experience about 20% more. These should have contributed to a positive goal difference of about 1, 3 and 1 goals respectively, or a total of plus 5. So England's goal difference of plus 16 was 11 goals better than you might have expected. That is not too shabby. Later in the book, we will reveal our global table for relative performance from 1980 to 2001. A ranking of the teams that did best relative to their country's experience, income and population. For now, we'll just say that England came in 67th out of 189 countries. That put them in a group of moderate overachievers, just below Russia, Azerbaijan and Morocco, and just above Ivory Coast and Mozambique. Like England, all these teams scored about a fifth of a goal per game more than they should have, given their population, income and experience. However, England doesn't benchmark itself against Azerbaijan. It's more interesting to see whether England overperforms more than the teams it sees as its rivals, the best countries in the world. Here's a ranking of the game's giants, plus England, based on how many goals per game each scores above expectations. Additional goals per game above expectations. Country. 1. Brazil, 0.67. 2. France, 0.35. 3. West Germany, 0.28. 4. England, 0.21. 5. Italy, 0.20. 6. United Germany, 0.18. 7. Argentina, 0.08. It turns out that England compare pretty well to the giants. Their overperformance is near the average for the world's leading nations, once we strip out the phenomenon that is Brazil. Now, let's look only at matches between European countries, the arena where England plays most of its football. The match results in Russell's database show that home advantage and experience count for a little less in Europe than in the world in general. On the other hand, population and GDP count for a bit more in Europe than in the world. Taking all that into account, against European teams, England overperform very slightly. From 1980 to 2001, they averaged 0.05 goals per game, more than you would predict given their experience, income and population. That put them in 23rd place of the 49 European countries we ranked. They were just behind West Germany in 20th place, but ahead of France, 25th, and Italy, 31st, even though those countries won tournaments in this period and England didn't. Our conclusion. England do just fine. They perform even better than expected, given what they have to start with. All they need to bring home some trophies is better timing. They must win fewer friendlies and more World Cup semis, and a few million more inhabitants. Consider the England-Germany semi-final at Euro 96. Both countries had similar levels of experience, and by 1996, Germans' lead over Britain in income per capita had slipped to only about 7%. However, according to our analysis, England's home advantage, worth just under half a goal in a game between Europeans, was largely wiped out by Germany's much larger population. That made the expected goal difference only 0.26 in favour of the English home team, not far short of the draw that materialised in open play. In the end, Gareth Southgate missed his penalty and England lost. Overall, in the 1980-2001 period, England played Germany 10 times. Taking the result at the end of normal time, England won 2, drew 3 and lost 5. Their goal difference over the 10 games was minus 2. Given Germany's slight lead in GDP per head in these years, but particularly given England's shortage of people, that is almost exactly the goal difference we would have predicted. The 30 years of hurt shouldn't be a mystery. If Britain keeps letting in immigrants, and if the German population drops by millions as predicted, and if English football finally enfranchises the middle classes, then that same match at Euro 2032 might have a different outcome. Though, given everything we know about life, possibly not. Phase 8. England enter the next World Cup thinking they will win it. Famously, there is a manic depressive quality to supporting England. The nation tends to feel either very high or very low about the team. The night of that home defeat to Croatia in November 2007 was a low. As we write, in spring 2010, most English fans feel high again. Capello's team ate up their qualifying group for the World Cup. People had begun to daydream about July the 11th, 2010, when a certain side might just be walking out for the final in Soccer City outside Johannesburg. Indeed, various people have asked us whether we aren't worried that the title of our book is about to be rendered out of date. That begs the question, is there really a Capello effect? Do his England have a better chance of becoming world champions than all those previous England teams? The first piece of evidence is the way his side breezed to qualification. Capello won an unprecedented 90% of his qualifying games. England manager qualification records, World Cup and Euros. Manager, Capello, played 10, won 9, drew none, lost 1. He won 90%, his win percentage 90%. Winterbottom, played 15, won 12, drew 3, lost none. He won 80% of the time. His win percentage is 90%. Ericsson, played 24, won 19, drew 4, lost 1. He won 79% of the time. His win percentage is 88%. Robson, played 28, won 17, drew 10, lost 1. He won 61% of the time, but his win percentage was 79%. Greenwood, played 18, won 13, drew 2, lost 3. He won 72% of the time, his win percentage 78%. Hoddle, played 11, won 7, drew 2, lost 2. He won 64% of the time, his win percentage 73%. Revy, played 10, won 6, drew 2, lost 2. He won 60% of the time, his win percentage 70%. Ramsey, played 21, won 12, drew 5, lost 4. He won 57% of the time, his win percentage 69%. Taylor, played 16, won 8, drew 6, lost 2. He won 50% of the time, his win percentage 69%. McLaren, played 12, won 7, drew 2, lost 3. He won 58% of the time, his win percentage 67%. Keegan, played 8, won 3, drew 3, lost 2. He won 38% of the time, his win percentage 56%. Wilkinson, played 1, won none, drew 1, lost none. He won 0% of the time, and his win percentage is 50%. Remember, the win percentage includes draws as half a win. If we set aside Walter Winterbottom, who worked in an era when England was economically much stronger relative to other nations, the only other manager who comes close to matching Capello's success is Ericsson. The Swede should be remembered as the great qualifier. For the first time since the 1960s, he ensured that England consistently made it to the major tournaments. It sounds reasonable to presume that a good qualifying performance presages a good tournament. But is this belief backed up by the facts? When England qualify in style, are they really more likely to excel at the final tournament? We check the data. England tried to qualify for 14 World Cups and Euros from 1980 through 2007. They didn't have to qualify for Euro 96. Of those 14 tournaments, they failed to qualify for 3 and got knocked out in the first round 4 times. That means that half the England teams in this period can be considered failures. Collectively, we'll label these teams bad England. Of the remaining 7 tournaments, England reached the round of 16 twice, the quarterfinals 4 times, and the semi-final once in 1990. We'll label these 7 teams good England. You would assume that good England did much better in qualifying matches than bad England. After all, bad England regularly failed even to qualify. Yet the data shows otherwise. In qualifiers, good England and bad England were much of a muchness. The England team at Euro 88, for instance, were unmistakably bad England. They lost all their 3 games in West Germany before going home with the hooligans. Yet they had qualified gloriously. 5 wins, 1 draw, no losses, and a goal difference of 19-4 and just 1 against. By contrast, the good England team of 1990 had muddled through qualifying, winning 3 and drawing 3. Even more curiously, England often performed just as well in qualifiers when it failed to make the tournament as when it succeeded. For example, in missing Euro 2008, England got exactly the same percentage of the available qualifying points, namely 66%, as when it managed to qualify for Euro 2000 or for the World Cup of 1982. Below is a comparison of the qualifying records of good England, teams that made at least the round of 16, versus bad England, teams that either missed the final tournament or went home after the first round. England's qualifying record since 1980. Team, bad England, played 60, won 36, drawn 16, lost 8, 4, 140, against 33. Good England, played 56, won 36, drawn 13, lost 7, 4, 106, against 28. The chart shows that good England and bad England had almost indistinguishable win-loss records in qualifying. Indeed, bad England scored many more goals than good England, while conceding only slightly more. The lesson of history, England's performance at specific World Cups and European Championships is almost entirely unpredictable. What we see here is partly the enormous role of luck in history. We tend to think, with hindsight, that a team that did well in a particular tournament was somehow always going to do well, and a team that lost was doomed to do so. The winner's victory comes to seem inevitable. This is a common flaw in the writing of any kind of history. But in fact, inevitable victories hardly ever happen in football tournaments. Perhaps the only recent case was Brazil at the World Cup of 2002. Just how dominant they were dawned on a leading European club manager a few months after the final. This manager was trying to sign Brazil's goalkeeper, Marcos. The player visited the club and did some physical tests, in which he didn't perform particularly well. Never mind, thought the manager, the guy won the World Cup. So he offered Marcos a contract. At 2 o'clock that morning, the manager was awoken at home by a phone call. It was Marcos's agent. The agent said, "I'm sorry, Marcos won't sign for you." The sleepy manager said, "All right, but why not?" Then the agent confessed. A couple of years before the World Cup, Marcos had broken his wrist. It had never healed properly, but his old club manager, Luis Felipe Scolari, became manager of Brazil and put Marcos in the team. Suddenly, Marcos was going to a World Cup. Every day at the tournament, the agent explained, Marcos was in pain. He could barely even train. In matches, he could barely catch a ball. Every day, Marcos told himself, "I really must tell Scolari about my wrist." But he could never quite bring himself to. So he went on, day by day, until he found that he had won the World Cup. Brazil was so superior that they won the World Cup with a crocked goalkeeper. However, such dominance is very rare. Normally, the difference between teams in the final stages of a World Cup are tiny.
You are listening to the Near Post Local on 2XXFM, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough.
The difference between an England team being considered legendary or a failure is 2 to 3 games, each generally decided by a single goal in 2 years. After all, the difference between making a World Cup and spending the summer on the beach can be just a point. Sometimes it's a point that you lost by hitting the post. Sometimes it's a point garnered by a rival in a match you didn't even play in. Once you're at the World Cup, the difference between going home ignominiously in the first round and making the semi-finals is often a matter of a few inches here or there on a couple of shots. In 1990, for instance, England got out of the first round by drawing with Holland and Ireland and then beating Egypt 1-0. Had a single Dutch or Irish shot happened to go in, or had Mark Wright's header against Egypt missed, Gazza would never have been able to parade around Luton in false breasts after the semi-final and unleash the new football. That World Cup was considered a success. The quarter-final of 2006, a failure. Yet it could almost as easily have been the other way around, if Paul Robinson had guessed right on a couple of Portuguese penalties in 2006. The greatest prize in sport hinges on a very few moments. It's the same in baseball, notes Michael Lewis in Moneyball. The season ends in a giant crapshoot. The playoffs frustrate rational management because, unlike the long regular season, they suffer from the sample size problem. Lewis means that because there are so few games in the playoffs, Because the sample size is so small, random factors play an outsized role in determining the winner. It's the same in Football World Cups, and even more so in European Championships. Euros only last 3 weeks, and, as Arsene Wenger notes, any team in a league can be top of the table after 3 weeks. Most fans understand that luck matters, even if they construct a post-fact story about the tournament that makes either the false breasts or the turnips seem fated from the start. But our data points to an even scarier truth than the existence of fluke, namely, that there is barely any difference between brilliant and terrible England teams. It looks suspiciously as if England, for almost all their history, at least before Capello, have been more or less equally good. This may sound hard to credit. Fans feel strongly about the qualities of managers and players. There have been periods of national optimism and national pessimism associated with the view that the England team is either strong or disgraceful. But in fact, watching England play has resembled watching a coin-tossing competition. If we focus on outright victories, then England, on average, win just over 50% of their games. The rest, they either draw or lose. So, just as a coin has half a chance of landing heads and half tails, England, in the average game, have almost half a chance of winning and half of not winning. We assigned a 1 for each win and 0 for a loss or draw, and examined the sequence of England's 400 games from 1981 to 2007. Before we discuss this sequence, let's look at coin tossing. If you tossed a coin 400 times, you would expect, on average, to get 200 heads and 200 tails. However, there is no reason to think that the outcomes would alternate. Heads, tails, heads, tails. Sometimes you will get sequences of a few heads, sometimes a few tails. Crucially, though, there would be no relationship at all between the current coin toss and the last one. If you toss a fair coin, there is always a 50-50 chance of heads, whatever sequence has occurred up to this point. There is no statistical correlation between current coin tosses and past coin tosses, even if the average of any sequence is always around 50%. Here is our finding. England's win sequence over the 400 games is indistinguishable from a random series of coin tosses. There was no predictive value in the outcome of England's last game, or indeed in any combination of England's recent games. Whatever happened in the last match appeared to have no bearing on what will happen tonight. The only thing you could predict is that over the medium to long term, England would win about half their games outright. We have seen that the outcome of matches can be largely predicted by a country's population, income and experience. However, this only explains the average outcome. In other words, if England were smaller, poorer or less experienced, it would have a lower percentage of wins, but the sequence of these wins would still be unpredictable. To make sure that our finding was right, we constructed a few random sequences of ones and zeros to see if they looked like the England results. Often, we found more apparent correlation in our random sequences than in England's results. Contrary to all popular opinion, it may be that the strength of the England team has barely ever changed, which would make the entire apparatus of punditry attached to the team instantly redundant. A star player might fade or retire, but in a country of 50 million people, there is always someone coming up who is near enough his level as to make almost no difference. Over the long term, the three key factors that determine a country's performance are very stable. The British economy may have boomed in the 1990s and is now dropping down the global wealth rankings, but measured over the last century, Britain has always been one of the wealthiest nations in the world. Equally, its share of the football population changes only glacially. And while the England team gains experience, so do its main rivals. The only key factor that changes is home advantage. Given that playing at home is worth a lead of 2/3 of a goal per game in global football, it's little wonder that England won the World Cup in 1966. The rest of the time, England generally feature in the global top 10, regularly beat weak countries, and fall 2 or 3 hurdles before the finish of major tournaments. That is a fair reflection of the nation's demographic and economic muscle, even if most people see someone richer and more powerful when they look in the mirror. In short, England's performances in good or bad times have been much the same. It's just that the fans and media have sought to see patterns where none exist.
You have been listening to the Near Post Local on 2XXFM, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. Football and futsal in the capital region. Go to the podcast for this program at www.nearpostlocal.blogspot.com. You will find a lot of interesting interviews and items there for the discerning football or futsal tragic. Enjoy your futsal and football. See you next time. Ta-da.